I craved a cheeseburger, which is rare for me, so I divvied over to a place I hadn't tried, the Levitt Street Inn, which is near Oakley and Fullerton, I guess. And on my bike ride there, a couple of streets were closed down for the filming of Chicago Fire, which is really cool. So what I didn't know is, like, if you go up to the, they'll actually have a production assistant escort you and your bike as you walk through the set. So I saw a lot of people standing around. I saw Taylor Kinney, the star, in full firefighter gear. And so that was really cool. And it's another reason to bike throughout the city if you can. When I got there, I sat outside on their very rustic patio and had a smash burger, which was super messy and gooey with secret sauce and pretty great. I would not wear your fancy clothes if you're going there. They did offer fries for an extra $7, but since the burger was already in the mid-teens, I'm like, I don't know if I can stomach that. Maybe as prices come down, maybe they'll just include the fries with the burger. I also had the opportunity to go to a new restaurant, Big Star Mariscos, which is on Ogden near Grand. Now, this is the seafood version of their very popular taco spots where they have in Wicker Park in Wrigleyville. A Mariscos, if you don't know, is basically the Spanish word for seafood or shellfish. And I have been going to Alegrias, which is on Ashland, kind of near Chicago Avenue, forever. We've had birthday parties there. We've picked up from there. It's a very authentic Mariscos where you'll hear lots of conversations in Spanish. We get the langostinos, which are kind of a shellfish that's in between a shrimp and a lobster. They have big platters of that. Or sometimes we'll get the red snapper and garlic sauce, which is just fantastic. At Big Star, it has a big patio. It's a lively room, lots of tequila, lots of bourbon. They have a ceviche menu and a taco menu, and I think they also include a whole fish. You don't hear many conversations in Spanish, but I had a very tasty shrimp taco and some tuna ceviche. And so maybe you want to check out both and see which ones you like. Alegrias on Ashland, Big Star in Ogden. Chicago Gourmet was also this past week. Everything was sold out. I had the chance to go to the Tacos and Tequila event on the Harris Theater rooftop. It was hosted by Rick Bayless. Of course, his line was super long. There were taco spots from all over the city. Pilsen, Bridgeport, Wicker Park. The star guest chef was from Miami, Michelle Bernstein, who owns several restaurants in Miami. And I've known Michelle forever because she is the host from its inception of Check Please South Florida. Also, I went to the Grand Cru event. Now, there's two of them on Saturday. There's Grand Cru 1 and there's Grand Cru 2. Wines from all over the world. The longest line was for Camus, which I understand it's a lovely bottle of wine. The longest line for the food offerings was for Esme and their Flamin' Hot Cheetos. There was great restaurants from Danielle in New York, Fabio Vivani, Lamar Moore, Tai Dang, and a great list, of course, of champagnes and wines from all over the world. If that's your thing and you can afford it, put it on the calendar for next year. I'm David Manilow. Welcome to The Dining Table, a place where we gather to share the good things in life. On this episode, Crane's Ali Marotti swings by to talk about tipping. Plus, Chicago Magazine's dining critic John Kessler joins me. 4+ years ago, he wrote a piece that did a fair share of ripping on Chicago. I'll ask him what's changed since then.
I think the West Loop is still the West Loop, honestly. I mean, sure, there's some very good restaurants out there. And if you go to the, you know, the far reaches of it where you find, you know, Smith and the Loyalist and Elska and other places, you know, that are, you know, yet to come a little bit more online. But the thick of the West Loop, I feel, is kind of, you know, it's the meatpacking district.
Food reporter Ali Marotti is here with the latest on the restaurant beat. Hey, Ali, how's it going?
Hey, it's going good. How are you?
I'm so good. What's going on?
So a little update on Tavern on Rush, which I know we have discussed on this podcast before. They announced that they were closing at the end of the year. It's been there for a quarter century. The news now is that the landlords will be putting a new restaurant in that building. They haven't disclosed really any details yet, but I confirmed with the alderman that they are doing some renovations to the space. They're going to reinforce the balconies on the second floor and put tables out there so people can sit. You know, they're going to update the dining room. There will still be a sidewalk cafe, I'm told. So stay tuned on that. That's something I'm going to keep a close eye on.
And some of their competitors may be forced to do something similar.
Exactly. It's sort of a race to the top, as they say. You know, next door Carmine's is renovating. You know, they actually, that building sold. The developer who bought it is tearing the whole thing down and building a new. Carmine's will go back in there. So that it's going to be a whole, you know, different look in that triangle area there. And I did talk to Gibson's and they said, we may need to start thinking about doing something similar, putting in second story, you know, deck as well, something along those lines.
That's kind of interesting, though, kind of looking down on Rush Street, I guess.
Totally. I mean, you know, I did talk to some people that were sort of like, oh man, it's the sidewalk patio that makes it what it is. You know, if Carmine's has a second floor patio, it's not going to be the same vibe, but, you know, just a different vibe, I think. It'll be interesting to see. So that won't be for like, you know, 16 to 18 months we're talking here with the way the construction's going to go. It'll take a while.
Gotcha. What else you got?
So the story that I did very recently about tipping in Chicago restaurants, I think is really interesting. So I had been hearing that servers and bartenders were getting tipped less as a result of inflation. And it's a little counterintuitive because, you know, theoretically, if prices are up on the menu, tips are going to be up too if you're still tipping your 15 to 20%, which is sort of the going rate. However, there's a study that came out that said almost one third of Americans are tipping less as they sort of try to pinch their pennies. And I talked to servers, bartenders throughout the city, as well as restaurant owners that say this is in fact happening. It's far from universal. You know, there are a few restaurants that I talked to that said this isn't happening. In fact, you know, it's going up with the prices. So that's good to hear. However, you know, some folks that I talked to said that it is getting hard. And a lot of people notice it. One server in particular, or one bartender I talked to up in the Albany Park neighborhood, she works at a cocktail bar, and said that basically as soon as this bar raised its prices over the summer, she immediately noticed people started tipping less and kind of balking at, you know, the costs of their cocktails.
Well, things are certainly expensive. I did see one restaurant recently that I saw it online and said, you know, whatever you make a reservation, and they put right there a 20% tip will be added to all bills.
Yes. So some restaurants are doing that. A lot of them started doing that, you know, over the pandemic, if they weren't already, for parties of six or more, et cetera, you know, to kind of see, to make sure that their servers were getting paid. I mean, the other thing that's going on here too is that the labor market's still very tight in the restaurant world. It's still hard for many restaurants to find workers. So the fact that this is also happening, you know, these restaurant operators are like, all right, if our servers are making less through tips now, we can't afford to offset it because, you know, we're still recovering from the pandemic. We have our own costs going up, et cetera, et cetera. And on top of that, like, it's going to not be as appealing to work here as a server if you're not going to make as much money. So that is a big concern for restaurant operators, I think.
And do you think that if you're a server in a restaurant and you go back a year, do you think the servers are actually making less money or the percentage tip is just down because the price is clearly up?
The prices are clearly up. You're right. So I think there's two different things going on. Well, actually more than two. And you're right. So throughout the course of the pandemic in the early days, we did see tips go up. There's not a lot of updated data on this because, again, this tipping less thing is a phenomenon that just started happening throughout the course of the summer because restaurants waited as long as possible to raise their menu prices to offset inflation because once menu prices go up, they rarely come back down, right? So it was sort of an effect of that. So we saw the tipping go up, and it wasn't super drastically when you looked at overall numbers. It was really just a couple percentage points here and there. So some say that that likely is coming back down. Again, the data is not there to support that yet. So that's something I'm going to watch in the coming months. But what is definitely happening is fewer people are tipping that full 15 to 20%. And also fewer people are eating out. So basically there's a survey from LendingTree that came out that said two thirds of Americans are eating out less to try to pinch their own pennies as well. So there's those two different things going on. And then, you know, I talked to a few folks about this that have studied how consumers behave when prices go up. And typically I'm told, you know, as a customer, as a diner, you've got this set budget that you're going to spend when you go out to eat. You're going to do something to keep within that budget, right? Maybe you're going to order one glass less of wine. But in some cases, you might be a little bit sticker shocked because you're not used to the prices being so high at this place you go. So once you've ordered everything, you get your bill and you're like, oh no, okay, I guess I better tip less. You know, and the servers and bartenders I talked to said that that's sort of what they're experiencing. It's definitely, once they give them the bill, it's this, whoa, this is the total kind of reaction.
Right. So what we want to caution diners is don't take it out on your server or your bartender just because the prices are high.
And the other thing that I think is really hard for restaurants to communicate to customers is, you know, a lot of them, like I said, they're still short-staffed, in which case that may be perceived as bad service, right? If your food is taking longer to come out because there's not as many waiters and waitresses on duty, but you're looking around at the restaurant saying, well, there's all these open tables, I don't understand. You know, but this is a problem that is definitely a hangover from the pandemic, right?
Like, sure.
Illinois lost 300,000 of its leisure and hospitality workers when COVID hit in spring 2020, and we have not built back up yet. So again, lots of people have left the industry permanently. It's still a struggle for a lot of restaurant owners.
I was out last night and you could tell that they were short-staffed at this restaurant. Mm-hmm. And so I was out with four of us. We said, we better order right away. Like, don't do the, oh, come back in 5 minutes. Let's look.
We're like,
we just dove in. We dove in. We're like, this, let's go. So that is one tip I can give you. But back to the real tips. So I've always had this problem. My family says it's just a problem I have. I don't understand the pre-tipping. I just don't understand the pre-tipping. Like, if you go to a place and they turn the little thing around, the console around, you've just ordered your food, you're at a counter, and it starts with like 22%. And I've seen it now in like fast food places. I'm so confused by that whole thing. It's like, I always kind of thought that tipping was for, you know, adequate or great service, right? So it's part of the deal.
Well, so first of all, I looked up on Emily Post, which is sort of, you know, the etiquette company that tells you how things are supposed to be done, right? So I looked that up and it said the going rate should be 15 to 20%
right.
For a full service sit down restaurant, right? And then if you're ordering a bar, it's $1 to $2 a drink or, you know, 15 to 20% of your total bill. We know, which I think the $1 to $2 a drink thing is something that we all learn, like in college, right? When you start going and drinking at bars. But then as you get older and you're buying fancier cocktails and they're craft cocktails, you know, this one server that I talked to said, I don't care if you tip me if I open a beer for you, right? But if I'm making you like a craft cocktail, you and your group craft cocktails, like it takes skill, it's time consuming, you know, that sort of thing. So to your point, I did not look what the going rate is for, like if you're ordering a muffin and a coffee, what is proper etiquette to tip, you know?
And one last thing that I was taught early in my relationship with my wife, who is a former waitress, is always tip better at breakfast because the prices aren't as high, but they're working probably even harder.
Yeah, for sure. That makes sense.
All right. Allie, great being with you. We'll talk next week.
Thank you for having me.
Joining me now is John Kessler, the dining critic for Chicago Magazine. And John, in preparation for this interview, I was looking for your article from 2018 and I couldn't remember the title. So I just Googled John Kessler rips on Chicago and there it came up and it was called The Party's Over. So I thought it was like a thoughtful and provocative article. You just moved here from Atlanta. So tell me, what has changed for the better or worse in the last 4 years since you wrote that?
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you for that. What has changed for the better is I believe that there has been a complete renovation of Chinatown and Bridgeport, and a lot of the Asian cooking in the city is new and fresh and vibrant. I think that the chefs in some of the more, I don't know, European-style restaurants or more American restaurants or more mainstream restaurants are cooking a little more seasonally, I believe, than when I first came here.
I'll go down the list of what you said, because you really had 5 points, and I thought they were all really interesting. One was that we don't really understand local seasonal cooking, and you addressed that, saying that's already improved. Two, you talked about you're looking for more exciting immigrant cooking, which I think you talked about a little bit in Chinatown, and there's more of that. I went to a Cambodian restaurant last night. Kasama certainly was really interesting. So the immigrant cooking, you say, has stepped up a little.
Yeah, very much so. And in terms of restaurants like Kasama or Wazwan, the Coach House at Wazwan, I think a lot of young chefs today are really mining their home cooking and, you know, their parents' cooking to combine with the, you know, moves they've learned working in restaurants. But also, you know, there's a lot happening all around the city. I just wrote a big package of stories about Koreatown that's started to develop in Glenview and north of there. They're just some wonderful places to go out and, you know, just get a real good taste of another culture.
But a lot of the restaurants that are opening up now are kind of like, it's more about, oh, I love the atmosphere. The vibe was so cool, right? Where I'm kind of looking for that and like, give me some great food. Give me some really interesting stuff. And so I see a lot of these things. And, you know, if you read, like, if you talk to people, you read, oh, I want to go there. It's Instagrammable or whatever.
It's true. And I've, you know, I'm working on our I'm already working on our best new restaurants issue for next year. And I've sort of developed this shorthand with my editor when I talk about, is this restaurant really worth spending the money at, or is it just there to separate you from some money, or is it actually,
right,
you know, worth what it's proposing? And it's a very slippery slope sometimes. I mean, sure, there can be some, you know, beautiful products that are, you know, available at certain restaurants, but I think the West Loop is still the West Loop, honestly. I mean, sure, there's some very good restaurants out there. And if you go to the, you know, the far reaches of it where you find, you know, Smith and the Loyalist and Elska and other places, you know, that are, you know, yet to come a little bit more online, I do feel like, you know, is it more of a scene or is it more of a restaurant? Is it actually going to be the splurge you want to have?
Well, I do think you can find both there. You can find both. It's just, it seems like several of the new ones, it's just the scene and people want to say they've been there and they want to like party and go. And the West Loop is vibrant and energized and I think fantastic for the city. So I have nothing negative to say other than I'd like to see some new restaurants where you in the West Loop where you kind of go like, wow, I had the greatest meal there.
Right. Like, you know, maybe like when the Publican first opened, that was so fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they know what they're, you know, they know what they're doing. So street food culture, you said we're kind of stuck in the past, I guess.
Yeah. And that's so hard because I always feel like everywhere I've been, I've reviewed restaurants in Denver, Atlanta, and here. And, you know, you're always going to rile up the natives. I mean, part of what you do is you hold up a mirror or a prism or something. Yes, I love a good hot dog. It's essentially the same experience over and over again, and I love it. And no, I don't think I'm ever going to like an Italian beef. I have absolutely nothing vested in the kind of nostalgia people have for that, you know, for that sandwich. So there are a lot of people who love to, you know, parse out, you know, like it's some calculus equation, the, you know, quality of different, you know, Italian beef sandwiches or tavern pies or whatever. But I just, you know, to be a critic, I want to politely be myself and say, yes, to me, a pizza is a different thing. And a tavern pie is kind of it can be very nice, but it's not something I crave or something that I think is the potential for greatness.
Well, I remember sitting at one of these pre-James Beard Awards parties, and a guy from New York was asking me, because he knew I was from here. He's like, oh, you know, the place that I hear you should go for pizza is this place called Illuminati, like the Illuminati. And I went, uh-huh. Do you mean Lumelnati's? And he goes, yeah. So they had elevated this thing to the Illuminati. And I was like, you're talking about Lou's? And I'm like, yeah, I guess. So, you know, it does go to a, you know, a higher plane, I guess. I don't know. And I will say The Bear, the TV show, The Bear has also elevated the Italian beef. So more and more people in this town, I think you're eating Italian beef in the last, you know, 2 or 3 months than they have in quite a while.
That's true.
Finally, your fifth topic was everybody's on Team Chicago and you kind of got to be a little bit more reflective. Now, John, I am totally on Team Chicago. I just want you to know that.
Great. I'm happy you are.
So I think that's a bad thing. And I think there's something about Chicagoans in our soul that we just, I mean, not everyone, but a lot of us just love being here and will defend it to the death.
Absolutely. As well you should. I mean, it's what an amazing city this is, what amazing culture it has produced, you know, what an effect it's had on the world in so many ways. That said, it can be, you know, you can very politely disagree with some things here, and boy, people let you know right away.
I want to go to your latest article. Now, this is about Alinea, and I understand sometimes, you know, provocative articles can get people talking. I think that's great. But you basically said that Alinea is, I think, out of step with the times. And you used one quote that I loved, and I wrote to you about it. You said it's like Hula Night at the White Lotus. And if people haven't seen The White Lotus, it's a TV show on HBO. And it's about kind of entitled rich people going to a resort and their kind of dealings and conflict with the staff. And Hula Night is when the staff and the locals perform. And yes, I could see how that is a little out of step. So to give me a little taste as to why you think Alinea either needs to upgrade their game or change, or they've just fell behind.
Well, you mentioned Kasama, and I think that if you look at what's going on today in dining, it is getting away from the white gaze is very important. And I think Alinea is all about the white gaze. You know, chefs are mining their own cultural heritage to open up dialogues about food. And it's very, very exciting time. Alinea did a lot for the world of restaurants. Alinea came around when Alinea opened. There is a very kind of stodginess in fine dining. I mean, the French Laundry is a beautiful tasting menu, but it's incredibly Eurocentric. And that was, you know, the finest restaurant in the country, arguably then. And I think what Alinea did is it blew open the doors to say, why not rethink the way that you taste and experience? Why not rethink association with food? In a very Chicago way, it said, why not mine nostalgia to unlock memories and use smells to make you think of, sceneries that are not sitting down in front of a table. And that was great then. I don't know if it works now. And I feel that the sense of surprise feels more like theatricality now rather than genuine provocation.
Right. I met Grant Ackett's from Alinea, the chef owner, in 2002 when he was cooking at Trio. So he was far ahead of the curve for a long, long time. But I will say something that I think is interesting when you talk about behind the times. Alinea pivoted and redid the restaurant, but I think they mostly redid the interior of the restaurant. I'm not so sure they've rethought what you're talking about.
Right. What they did is they created two different experiences so that you had an upstairs and a downstairs. And the downstairs is something they like to call a multi-sensory experience. And that did a couple of things. One, it created a situation where there are five tables and everyone can be served at once so that the element of surprise is maintained throughout the meal. You're not watching other tables in different stages of their meals. Two, they could create the situations where there's places in the meal where there would be something, you know, that would happen. I mean, when they first opened, the rooms would fill with smoke from dry ice that had been hiding on the table under a bowl of fruit. And, you know, LCD sound system would start blaring through the room and it would shake you a bit.
They were always progressive. Is it possible that just some of these other places have caught up and put their own stamp on fine dining, prefix, just the entire experience? Because I always encourage people, if they can afford it, I'm saying, you know, you don't have to be a regular at any of these places, but you should try Alinea once. You should try Oriole. You should try Kasama. You should try one of those places or all of those places just to understand what's out there.
If it's within, you know, the Venn diagram of you're interested in food and your budget, absolutely you should. If you're going to, you know, if you're somebody who is saving up money to, you know, treat your partner to a, you know, once a year special occasion and you're unfamiliar with this kind of food, I would direct you away from Alinea toward Oriole, where I think there's, you know, a bit more of warmth and soul that is being communicated to my, you know, and again, I say, this is my impression. I am one dude. I am, you know, I try to be polite about it, but it's what I feel.
Okay. I'm going to pivot for a second. This is more about you than about food. I'm asking you three questions that I've asked everybody. So the first one is, and it doesn't have to be about food. It can be, but this could be about, you know, it could be about golf or puppies or I don't care. So tell me, and this is about you really. So tell me three things you love.
Three things I love. Okay, give me a sec. There's an organization in Atlanta I work with called The Giving Kitchen. It is a organization that supplies sort of micro grants to people in the food service industry who are facing crisis. Whenever I'm doing something with them, it's just this feeling of feeling very sad and very happy and very part of a community. And so I love that. I love my rooftop garden, which is, you know, we live in a townhouse in Bucktown, and I've got a patio and I have a zillion potted plants and I'm learning how to do that. And so I putter around there. I don't know. I mean, what else do I love? I love my 22-year-old cat.
Did you say 22?
Yeah. We have a 22-year-old cat who is like a race.
Oh my God. Okay, next question. Tell me one thing you can't be without in the kitchen.
I kind of love my yondu. It's spelled Yondu. It's a Korean seasoning made of yeast extract and soy extract. And it's basically like MSG without MSG. It's the boost that I put it in everything and it just makes everything taste better.
That's awesome.
Yondu. And it comes in a pear-shaped bottle and you can get it at H Mart or at Jungbu.
Love it. Okay, last question. Your favorite food experience?
My wife and I have three kids. And when our oldest was just 2 years old, we took a trip to France. And my best friend is a French guy who I met in a youth hostel when I was 17, and he became an accountant for wineries and for a wine merchant. And so we took a trip to Burgundy together and we ate at a restaurant called La Meloise, which is a famous old school restaurant in Burgundy. And I just kind of remember that meal, just how great the wine was. Pigeon in a pig's bladder was the specialty. And my wife thought she was getting poulet de Brest, this, you know, special chicken from the area, but ended up ordering fish. And as she was eating it, she says, "Wow, this chicken really is very strange." So, it was an incredibly funny moment. So. Hey,
that's awesome. Yeah. John Kessler, thank you so much. It was really, really a pleasure talking to you.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure meeting you. And I'm a big fan of Czech Police. It really, you know, when I first moved here, I watched some of it and it really helped me out trying to figure the city out a bit.
That's our show this week. Special thanks to my guest, John Kessler from Chicago Magazine. And thanks to Ali Marotti, who works the restaurant beat for Crane's Chicago Business. You'll find her work at chicagobusiness.com. Remember to check the show notes for links to the people and places we talked about during this episode. The Dining Table with David Manilow is produced by Todd Manley. We always appreciate your ratings and comments. It's the best way for others to find these conversations. I'm David Manilow. We'll keep feeding you the good things in life.